Ms. Kilburn. Ms. Kilburn, if you're online, please state your name for the record. Actually, we're going to take a short pause because I started doing it at the last hearing. So the first person is Aldean Kilburn. I recognize it's about 1:05 and Representative Eastman has joined us. Aldean Kilburn was appointed March 1st of this year. It is her first appointment. Her term would expire on March 1st of 2025. Ms. Kilburn, if you want to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Aldean Kilburn. I've been married to the same man for almost 49 years, and I have 3 sons and 1 grandson. I've lived in Fairbanks since 1972, although I've been fortunate to travel extensively throughout Alaska, including rural communities. I graduated from the University of Washington in 1972 with a degree in political science and a minor in French. I earned a teaching certificate from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and substituted and taught in the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District secondary schools from 1974 until 2005. At that point, I returned to school at the University of Washington and earned a master's in library and information science in 2007. For the next 5 years, I worked as a cataloger and a part-time librarian at the University of Alaska's Geophysical Institute. I've previously served for 8 years on the Advisory Council on Libraries as one of public members and considered asking to be reappointed. However, I believe in public service and think fresh eyes are often needed, a reason to move on. Teaching high school government classes, my students were required to attend at least 1 trial and write about it. They also had judges and lawyers come and talk to them in class. My middle school student classes were able to visit courtrooms and have judges and lawyers talk with them, and we often utilized well-known cases to showcase in the classroom students taking parts of various participants. Based on students who've reminisced with me over the years, these have been very positive experiences for them. I've written letters of recommendation for students who want to apply to participate in the local North Star Youth Court, and I've also served as a juror several times. As a public member, I feel I have the intelligence to listen to what is presented to the commission and to make a fair judgment in each situation. As a layperson, I would be representing the general public's interests. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Ms. Kilburn? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Kilburn, for putting yourself forward for this excellent public service. I'm curious, in your employment history, you're showing a Project Chris trainer for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. Can you explain what Project Chris is or was, please?
Project Chris was something that came out of Kalispell, Montana, by a group of secondary teachers who said, we teach to the kids, they fail the test, what's going on? CRIS stands for Creating Independence Through Student-Owned Strategies. They're not a CAN program. It's more you learn to teach kids to communicate between a partner with a group, to look at various presentations. You assume that when somebody reads something that they understand it, but unfortunately for middle school and high school students, that isn't necessarily the case. And these strategies that I was a teacher for, not only the Fairbanks North Star Borough, but I also went to Kotzebue and did a presentation up there, it's something that I used when I was going back to school for my master's. It's a successful program that was once rated as one of the top 10 programs in the nation by the White House.
Great. Thank you very much.
I don't see any other questions for Ms. Kilburn. Thank you very much for joining us today. Next online is Jane Moores. Jane Moores was first appointed on April 2, 2019. That term expired on March 1st of 2020. She was reappointed on March 1st of 2020, and the term she's currently serving in is scheduled to expire on March 1st of 2024. I know she was before this committee in 2019. She may have been before this committee last year. I don't remember. She may. And Ms. Morris, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Klayman and distinguished members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Jane Morris, and I am before you today as a reappointed attorney member of the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct. I live here in Juneau with my husband, Peter, and have been practicing law in Alaska for just over 30 years, first in Anchorage, then in Haines, and since 2000 here in the capital city. I retired from the City and Borough of Juneau Law Department in 2019 and opened a private law practice here in town last year. Because a personal commitment to ethical conduct has been a guiding beacon throughout my legal career, service on the commission has been particularly meaningful to me. I understand that the public trust in our judicial system heavily depends on the oversight of judicial conduct, and I can confidently report to the commission, as I believe some of the other appointees have as well, that the commission has been providing excellent oversight and it's doing its job very well. It's been my privilege and honor to serve the public by contributing to the important work of the Judicial Conduct Commission the last 2 years, and I look forward to continuing my service for a full 4-year term should I be confirmed. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, and I thank you very much for your time and consideration.
I just note for the record, for those that aren't aware, that Ms. Moore's sister is Senator Hughes. Questions for Ms. Moore's? Ms. Moore's, I see no questions, and I appreciate your... Representative Drummond got me just before I got you off the hook. Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I don't have any questions. For Jane, I just wanted to tell you it's nice to hear your voice, and I wish we weren't in this situation of having to hear your voice and not be able to see your face or talk to you in the room. Thanks very much for stepping forward in this volunteer effort.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and I'd note, I'm not sure when she came in on Teams, but Rep. Snyder, my vice chair, has joined us as well. And Ms. Moores, I too, I'm sorry that you can't be here with us. I've always enjoyed the opportunity to see you here in Juneau, and always remember the fact that I was at dinner with you and your now husband on your first date. So thank you very much. I will now, since there are no other questions from the committee, we're going to open the room for public testimony. I don't see anyone online that wants to speak to the two individuals, and I see only the insurance commissioner, and I know she's not here to provide testimony as to these two appointments, so I'm going to close public hearing on these two appointees. That brings us to final comments, and as to either of these two applicants, we'll start with Representative Vance. Anything to add? Representative Eastman? Representative Kirka? Has Representative Christ Tompkins joined us on the phone? No. Representative Snyder, anything to add? Representative Drummond?
Nothing.
I too have nothing, so that, having heard no comments, Representative Snyder. Be sure to turn your mic on, too.
One moment, please. It appears I'm missing an important document. Here we go. Thank you, Chair. The Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees and recommends that the following names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration: Aldine Kilbourn and Jane Moores to the Commission on Judicial Conduct. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
The names will be forwarded to the joint session. Please be sure to stay behind to sign the confirmation committee report. And Representative Snyder, be sure to come down as well to sign the confirmation committee report. Our second and final order of business today is House Bill 29, Electric Utility Liability, sponsored by Representative Rauscher. This is the third hearing in the Judiciary Committee. During our last hearing, we adopted Amendment Number 1 offered by Representative Snyder, and we held the bill for further review in light of questions raised by an Anchorage Daily News article reporting on a collection of insurance companies suing the Matanuska Electric Association in an attempt to recoup the cost of fire insurance claims from the McKinley Fire in 2019. Before we consider moving House Bill 29 from committee, I would like to make sure we answer any questions related to insurance companies and insurance rates. And a note for the committee that we have several individuals online that we've invited to answer questions. And I think actually some of them, we may actually get a statement from them. But at present, we have Lori Winghire, Director, Division of Insurance, who's in the room with us. Karen Collins, Assistant Vice President of Personal Lines, American Property Casualty Insurance Association, also known as APCIA. Lynn Elliott, Assistant Vice President, State Government Relations, American Property Casualty Insurance Association. Also have Norm McDonald, Chief of Fire and Aviation, the Division of Forestry from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Oops. And Acting Director and State Forester, Tim Dabney, Division of Forestry, Department of Natural Resources. And I'm pretty sure that I believe that I was going to actually give an opportunity both to Ms. Elliott and Ms. Collins to make a statement before we take questions. So I'll start. Ms. Elliott, if you would like to identify yourself, state your name for the record and any affiliation, and then you can make a statement with connection with House Bill 29 and perspectives you can offer with your group.
Thank you, Chairman Klayman. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, terrific. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Lynn Elliott. I am the Assistant Vice President of State Government Relations with American Property Casualty Insurance Association, APCIA for short. And Mr. Chair, I will be giving a statement today. Karen Collins is on to answer any technical questions that might be beyond my subject matter depth. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. Earlier today, you and the committee would have received a joint letter from APCIA and the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies, NAMIC for short, outlining some concerns we have with House Bill 29 as drafted. The public policy around wildfires, as you all know, is a very critical issue in the West. Our members care a great deal that Western states have successful policy management in place. And just very quickly, I will mention the two concerns. Our letter goes into more detail. Number one, we feel that House Bill 29 grants a very broad immunity from liability to utilities, probably beyond the scope that we are comfortable with. And secondly, the vegetation management plan, as currently outlined, really lacks any specificity or an oversight authority to ensure that the plan meets proper guidelines. We simply want to make sure that there is a proper balance that takes into account the needs of the utilities, the property owners, and the insurers. We don't think House Bill 29 quite gets there yet. In addition to the joint letter that we submitted to the committee, that goes into more detail about our concerns, we also proposed what we believe are good amendments that provide that proper balance, and those are included as well. We want to work with your committee and other parties to collaborate on an appropriate solution to address this very important issue of wildfire. As I said, we're pleased to answer any questions, and my colleague Karen Collins, who is a policy expert on mitigation and climate change, is here to address anything more technical than I can handle. And with that, Mr. Chair, we're happy to answer any questions.
Okay, and I'd also note, in addition to the folks I earlier identified, we also have Andy Lehman, General Counsel, Alaska Power Association, Crystal Enquist, Executive Director, Alaska Power Association, Jim Butler, Advisor, Homer Electric Association, and attorney, and those are the other people that are available online. So at this point, I would open it up to questions from members of the committee for it. Well, actually, just a moment. Ms. Elliott, am I correct that Ms. Collins is here for questions but not to make a formal statement?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is correct.
Okay, so now this is open to the committee for questions. Are there any of the folks that are Representative Kirka?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just reading this letter and was going to compare it to the bill. I'm a little confused on the third paragraph here. The statement is made that the if the wildfire is caused by the company's negligence, the company would have the argument they are statutorily immune from the civil liability. And I was trying to go back and check the bill language. It was my understanding that it's only the bill scope in this sense only applies to things outside their control in terms of trees falling in. And I could see the concern that the language may be too broad, but it seems like this is an equally or more so broad statement that they're, I mean, are we saying that they're completely immune from things within their control, they're negligent for? I mean, that's not what the intent of the, or the language of the bill is, to my understanding.
Is it, who's it a question for?
I think the legal counsel for the insurance company.
So that sounds like a question, and they represent a collection of insurance companies. They're not any particular company. Is that better for Ms. Elliott or Ms. Collins?
Mr. Chairman, this is Lynn Elliott. Let me take a stab at that. I'm not sure if I completely understand the question. I do know that the bill as crafted does not speak to that if the utility is negligent, that they cannot be found, you know, they cannot have immunity from liability. That's the way we understand it. But we just want to make sure that the language is drafted, accounts for situations where property owners whose property may be damaged due to something caused on utility property, that there is some ability for them to have compensation. Does that help answer the question? I might have missed the mark a little bit on that.
Representative Kirka, does that respond to the question?
Hold on, wait.
We have a, she's got a second. Ms. Collins, go ahead, and if you want to add to the analysis before we see if that answers Representative Kirka's question.
Sure, absolutely. The insurance.
And formally, you need to identify yourself for the record and your affiliation before you answer.
Yes, of course. My name is Karen Collins, and as introduced, I work with the American Property Casualty Insurance Association supporting property-related matters, including wildfire issues.
Okay. Proceed with your...
The bill is proposed that the concern that the insurance industry had was when we look at the issues that are on an easement that utility equipment exists on, those generally tend to be straightforward. However, when there is vegetation on property that is not in the control of the utility company, this is where there's more of a concern on how that negligence and liability needs to be constructed in the language. So many of the proposals that you'll see further delineate those particular issues. The introductory paragraph makes it clear that if vegetation is completely outside of the boundaries and does not come in contact, then we're not concerned with that situation. However, if there is vegetation on a property outside, which at some point does come into contact with the utility resulting in fire, this was part of the original proposed language that we take issue with, simply because the vegetation management plan of the utility should be taking into consideration vegetation that does not exist on their land, particularly if it presents a hazard, a safety threat to the public. And so as we've seen in many states, there are rights of way that should be granted that allow them to deal with those high-risk vegetation issues that are outside of their boundaries, that are on a separate property owner's land. And so what you will see in a lot of the proposed language is providing a immunity for the utility company to go onto those properties when there is high-risk vegetation, so they may address and remediate that threat. So immunity for trespass, for example, we've included language for that to give them that opportunity to go and address that. And then further, much of the language that you'll see that's been added is really the establishment of
the vegetation management plan itself and the oversight and authority for that.
Representative Kirka, does that answer the question you raised?
Yeah, I think it clarifies some of the concerns. I was just, the statement in the testimony, the letter here, seemed to make a very broad statement that I didn't think was accurate with the bill. I think that clarified their concern.
Thank you. Other questions for any of the folks online? Representative Vance, you look like you're on the verge of a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am taking a look at the proposed amendment, and on page 1, it is 1B that I have a question about. It describes if an electric utility identifies vegetation along but outside of its real property, and it goes further down, that it may enter onto the property and perform vegetation management pursuant to the Wildland Protection Plan. The electric utility may not be held liable for trespass as long as its actions are limited to those necessary to comply with Wildland Protection Plan. And what I would like to know from the drafter, why they included this provision in there when I feel like property owners may not appreciate the trespass. So is this a regular part of utilities? Is this a normal activity? I have concerns with this and would just kind of like to know the intent behind 1B.
And I think Ms. Collins is probably one to answer that question, but before she answers, I would just note that it's my general understanding that the proposed language that came from the insurance group is largely patterned after the Utah law that passed in 2020, which we earlier circulated a copy. I don't think it's entirely identical, but I think it's modeled after what Utah did. And I think the biggest thing that Utah did was they said that the Public Utility Commission, or in our case the RCA, if we were to adopt similar language, would be responsible for approving basically vegetation management plans so that they would be establishing a standard of conduct for the utility companies. And I think that's part of the context of their proposed amendment. But it sounds like Ms. Collins, you're the one to answer Representative Vance's question.
Sure. Am I still audible to you?
Yep, absolutely. And state your name again before you start.
Yes, this is Karen Collins once again from APCIA. The intent of this language is to really address right-of-way access, which, yes, to your question, we are including language for addressing right-of-way issues in multiple states. Clearly, there are separate property owners with separate rights, but when you have the threat to public safety as a result of wildfire and, again, hazardous vegetation that must be addressed, this is where you can't just provide immunity if a utility addresses what's on their property, but there is knowingly a threat in an adjacent property, such as a dead or drying tree that could have the entire tree fall onto the utility or branches that get carried over or whatever your scenario might be. And so if there is a vegetation management plan that identifies this specific vegetation as a threat, it's part of their plan. They've requested to the property owner to go in and mitigate this, and if there is potentially a denial to this, this would give them the ability to go and address that for those issues that would present a public safety threat.
Follow up. Representative Vance.
Thank you for that answer. I will have to reread the language again to make sure that there would indeed be communication to the property owners prior to any trespass. And the reason that I bring this up is because the city of Homer has been clearing rights of way, and it has created a big stir in the community of property owners who wanted to groom the vegetation themselves in a way that was still presentable, and the city having the large cutters would come along and just hack up the alders and things like that, and it It wasn't appealing, aesthetically appealing. And so there's been a lot of pushback on what is considered adjacent and truly, you know, harm, not necessarily for fires, but for rights of way. And so I think I'd like to look at a balance of that and make sure that we indeed include proper communication if we were to adopt this language. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I just know this language is not before us. It's more of an example. Representative Kirka.
thank you for that, Chairman. Thank you for that clarification, because when Representative Vance pointed out, I read it, and I'm extremely alarmed by that language. In Article 1, Section 7 of the Alaska's Constitution, it says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or, in this context, property, without due process of law. The way I would read that language, and I would need to fully examine the whole potential language here, this is essentially giving the utilities and their employees property rights on other people's property, and it's a violation of the Constitution. I can't support that the way it is. But I do see the need for further language, potentially, that maybe more narrowly defines the liability issue. I could see that argument, or dealing with or rectifying some of those concerns. Just the way that amendment is drafted, that's a non-starter.
Okay. Representative Vance.
If I may, I apologize.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's Thank you. I do have another.
You know the deal. You can ask all the questions you want. You just have to get them out quickly.
I do have another question, different topic. This is on the second page of the letter that says the proposed civil liability immunity, the first paragraph on the second page, the proposed civil liability immunity provision in this bill could adversely impact affordability of homeowners insurance for consumers. And can she speak to the concern about, is this directly, you know, possibility of increasing rates because of this? You know, I think that's something that definitely needs to be spoken to on the record.
And is that better answered by Ms. Elliott or Ms. Collins?
Mr. Chairman, this is Lynn Elliott with APCIA. I think Karen Collins can better answer this one than I can.
Ms. Collins, sounds like you're on the docket again.
Sure. This is Karen Collins with APCA. Happy to answer this. The mounting losses that we as the industry are experiencing, unfortunately, as a result of wildfires, does present a significant cost and burden to policyholders. We have seen this, unfortunately, in California, and we're also beginning to see this in other states that are experiencing these wildfires of a very catastrophic nature. With regard to utilities, and really any situation where there is a party that is potentially responsible for the ignition of a wildfire, if there is liability that exists there, as the insurance carriers, we will pay for the losses that we have for our policyholders to restore them to a position prior to that fire. However, if there is a responsible party that we can pursue to recover some of those costs, yes, that does impact the premiums and the costs that policyholders pay. If we're able to recover those because another party was liable at fault for that, those recoveries, which are known as subrogation, come back and essentially help to maintain affordable costs. If we were to lose the ability to pursue an at-fault party, then the policyholders would unfortunately be impacted because the cost that insurance carriers have to charge would then be passed along to them directly.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
Ms. Collins, you mentioned that you've seen this rate rise in California. Obviously, they've had a wide-scale, you know, fires there. But have you seen the rates increase in states that have passed similar bills?
Many of the bills, I'm sorry, this is Karen Collins again with APCA. Many of the bills have been in response to the recent wildfire season, so it is hard to place an exact number on that simply because of the recency of this. But yes, protecting our rights to subrogation has been a critical I don't know the right terminology, goal is maybe not quite the right word I'm reaching for, but just preserving this ability to continue to maintain affordability and balance. We are watching these wildfire seasons closely. We had, of course, 2017 and 2018 were devastating in California. We saw many of these bills begin to pass in that state, and now we're seeing after last year's 2020 wildfires, which impacted so many additional western states, an additional round of bills in more recent sessions. So, again, the recency of these is hard to give you a pattern over time, but it is clear that if that option was removed from the table for insurers to find that balance, that over time, and certainly with the understanding that the risks of climate change and drought and other issues that are compounding these issues would become far more problematic and costly.
One more follow-up.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Collins, how many Alaskan policyholders does your group represent? Or, how many are affiliated with you?
So they're actually work for, they're an affiliation of the companies. They don't write policies.
Okay.
They may be able to tell how many members write insurance up here.
Mr. Chairman, this is Lynn L.
Go ahead.
With a address that I can speak to in general. In Alaska, there are 520 companies that provide property casualty insurance. Five PNC insurance companies are domiciled in Alaska, and there are three headquartered there. I hope that helps.
A lot of insurance available.
That was a large number.
All right. Other question, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Now, I'm specifically looking at the proposed amendment, and I understand that's coming from Utah.
Actually, it's not a proposed amendment. It's just language we might consider. There's no amendment.
Yes, so recommended, I think, might be the better word. So the recommended amendment. And I am looking to know, in places like Utah, where they do allow utility employees to do, in effect, what would be trespass if they didn't already have the wild plan exemption, when they're going onto private property, is there usually some kind of hold harmless that goes on to the property owner? I know if someone's posted no trespass and then someone walks onto the private property and gets caught in a trap line or falls into an open pit, I think usually the homeowner is not responsible. Does that type of hold harmless generally follow in this kind of situation as well?
Mr. Chairman, this is Lynn Elliott with APCIA. Maybe I can provide some context. I'm sorry, Representative Kirk, I cannot answer that question directly because the bill in Utah only passed last year, so it's only been into effect for a series of months. And I have not been privy to any of the mitigation management plans that would have been approved by the Public Utilities Commission there. But I can tell you that the insurance industry did work with the utilities to negotiate the amendments that ended up in the Utah legislation as passed, which removed the insurer's opposition, and that was acceptable language by both the utilities and the insurers.
Thank you.
And I just can't speak directly to the hold harmless.
And Ms. Elliott, unrelated to that, it's my impression that they passed a statute in Utah, and that similar legislation is under consideration in many of the western states, but very few have actually passed a new law, maybe California. But it's not, even though it's under consideration in a number of places, it hasn't passed in very many. Am I correct on that, or am I off?
Mr. Chairman, Lynn Elliott with APCIA. Yes, that's correct. And Karen is based in Sacramento. She may be able to speak more fully to the California law.
Yes, this is Karen Collins with APCIA. My understanding is that the California law and the Utah law have passed, but only just in the most recent legislative session, maybe in the last year or two. We have certainly coming out of the 2020 wildfire season, which impacted so many additional western states, more recent legislation, which is now being proposed in the current 2021 legislative session, and that is mostly in response to what has been a growing concern across all of the shared western states.
And so I have a follow-up question from Ms. Collins, because you're based in California and are aware of some of the situations. Has there been, in terms of insurance policies being written for homeowners, have there been issues with companies in California wanting to stop writing insurance in this area?
This is Karen Collins with APCA. Yes, absolutely. There is an availability, some call it crisis at this point in California, because of a number of challenges related to wildfire in the state. There's many varying underlying reasons for that, and we would like to avoid similar challenges, of course, in other states, but the growing increase of issues from climate change and drought and the accumulated fuel loads that we have, as well as the increasing number of properties that are being built into what is referred to as the wildland-urban interface, or WUI for short, have accelerated the issues that did not exist, say, just 5-10 years ago. And these trends are certainly alarming and continuing to increase. And the cost of these very large catastrophic wildfires in 2017, 2018, and again in 2020, the increased frequency and the increased severity as a result of these other contributing factors has made a very concerning outlook for insurers, as well as the reinsurance industry, which provides additional capital to provide availability in the insurance marketplace. And so, again, to the point of this bill, HB 29, preserving the health of the insurance marketplace is a critical priority for insurers, to ensure that we preserve all means possible to keep rates affordable and to also maintain the availability in the market.
So it sounds like two things happen when losses increase. One, the rates go up, but sometimes some companies will just choose to stop offering the insurance at all. They just withdraw from that market. And you've seen both of those things happen in California?
This is Karen Collins again with APCA. We have seen these challenges in California for multiple reasons. The regulatory environment in California is a very difficult one. Trying to respond with rate increases requires approval by the regulatory authorities, the California Department of Insurance. There have also been other regulations that have been imposed on insurers that prevent their ability to manage the portfolio of exposures in a way that is common in other states. So there's a tightening of the regulatory authority that has really put an uncomfortable place on insurers and how they can manage. And that is not something that is unique to other states. That is a very unique issue in California currently. But as these continued seasons unfold with these increase in losses, that has made it very challenging for insurers, where it creates uncertainty on what the marketplace is going to look like within a year, a couple of years from now, and not being able to price accordingly. And so there is very much a destabilization that has happened in California, which we would like to prevent in other states. Managing this is a very critical priority for the insurance industry. So we're trying to be very reasonable with all the stakeholders and finding a good balance of what that can be, but not releasing what are very standard tools within our ability, such as subrogation rate.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. I did have
Mr.
some.
Mr. Chair, this is Snyder. I didn't want to get in the queue, please.
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead, Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't feel like I have a complete grasp on everyone we have on the phone, so this may be a question just for the record that has to be answered at a later time. Barring the what I feel are legitimate concerns associated with this draft amendment under discussion regarding access to private property, I do understand the concerns there. I am liking this discussion about providing better clarity around the vegetation management plan. I think in the original bill that we've been working with, that phrase is doing a lot of work without me having a, without it, what that plan actually has to be and must be. And my reading of this draft amendment that we're looking at today suggests that we don't currently have anything solidly in statute that dictates what a vegetation management plan must be or include, or who would have to approve it. Is my takeaway accurate? Is there someone on the phone today that, that could clarify that, make sure my understanding is correct? And if not, put a pin in that.
It's, as the chair of the committee, I believe your understanding is correct. The reason that they proposed the language is to create a structure so that the in Alaska, their suggestion is that we should come up with a mechanism so that the Resource Committee, Regulatory Commission of Alaska, actually approves the vegetation management plan as a regulatory matter. So it's not just a utility does what it thinks is reasonable, and you might have utility A with one plan that looks a certain way, and utility B has a dramatically different plan, and then there's a fire, and somebody said, when there's a lawsuit, and they say, well, your plan wasn't adequate, you should look at Company B's plan. That's a really good vegetation management plan, and because you made a poor plan, you're liable for the negligent plan. And then you get into arguments about what is a reasonable plan, and you then get in a contest of experts in a lawsuit about what constitutes a reasonable plan. The Utah structure essentially makes it so that the plans become subject to regulatory approval, and that and then you have established a standard that people can look to. And I would ask Mr. Lehman, your general counsel for the Alaska Power Association, do you agree with the description I just gave, or do you take a different approach to it? And weigh in, please.
Yeah, Andy Lehman, general counsel for the Alaska Power Association, through the chair. You know, the idea of adopting something like what's been done in Utah, I do think there's some issues. But the idea that that's the direction folks might be considering isn't really one that we've had a chance to talk about yet. So I guess we would like to get back to you. I would say that I think Representative Snyder is correct that there's not a statutory definition or requirement for vegetation management plans. And of course, I'm betting that if we went up to the North Slope, you would not find utilities there with vegetation management plans. They'll probably get one when they need one, right? Whereas I think this committee heard testimony earlier in the prior hearings of this bill that when you're talking about utilities that do have vegetation, they all have vegetation management plans that they follow, and they have to because, to ensure their operational stability, their reliability, their ability to serve their members. If they're not managing their vegetation, the lights are going out and their members are complaining. And finally, I do think it's worth reminding everyone that in Alaska, you know, almost all utility customers are the owners of the utility, because we have cooperatives, and cooperatives are owned by their customers, and there's a high level of accountability between the customer and the utility that you don't have maybe as frequently in other parts of the world, but we do here.
And a follow-up in terms of what I was describing, do you view if somebody wants to argue about whether the vegetation management plan is adequate or not adequate, does the fact that there's no regulatory oversight of that mean that one could get into a court situation in which there's contests about whether the plan of that a utility has is or is not adequate?
Andy Lehman, for the record, I think it is true that right now in Alaska, right, if when there's a fire, the standard is negligence, and it's a reasonable person, and I think you're absolutely correct, Chair Klayman, that you would have battles of experts over did the utility have a reasonable plan, did they follow it, right? That would be part of that analysis. And, you know, what's a jury going to say? The goal of this bill was, again, not to give absolute immunity to utilities. It was to better define ahead of time and make clearer lines for where there's going to be liability and where there's not. The first clear line is if it's vegetation that's outside the right-of-way that the utility doesn't have control over, it's not, you can't expect the utility to, we can't do anything about it, so you can't, you know, expect the utility to be responsible for those damages. And then the second part being for vegetation within the right-of-way, to set a clear standard that the standard ought to be, well, what was the utility's plan and did they follow it? Because, again, they all have these plans. This isn't a new idea. And they all have incentives to have good, reasonable plans because they have to keep the lights on.
Okay, thank you. I also, we'd ask the folks from the Division of Forestry to attend today, and I'm not, so both Mr. Dabney and Mr. McDonald are online, and I've had, in advance, I'd asked them to see if they could answer the question, how much did the state spend on fighting? I think we had three fires, the McKinley fire, the Swan Lake fire, and the Deshka fire, if I've got it right, the three most recent wildfires that led to, I think, an emergency declaration. Yeah, I'm not sure whether better Mr. Dabney or Mr. McDonald. Can one of you tell us about how much we spent fighting those fires and whether all that money comes out of the state treasurer or how that gets paid? And I'm leaving it open as to who's a better one to answer, Mr. Dabney or Mr.
Chairman Clayman, this is, for the record, my name is Norm McDonald. I'm the Chief of Fire and Aviation for the Alaska Division of Forestry, and I can answer that question for you. You referenced three fires, and just to make sure I have them right, with the Swan, Deshka Landing, and McKinley. In that order of cost, the Swan, and just, this is all preliminary, final billing actually will be done within the next month, but right now it's at $44.5 million. That's for the Swan fire.
Speak a little bit slower.
Okay. Yeah, for the Swan fire, that is at $44.5 million. And just as a point of reference, that was a federal fire. It started on Fish and Wildlife Service land and 100% reimbursable to the federal government, so no cost to the state of Alaska on that incident. The second fire you referenced was the Deshka Landing fire. This is in the Mat-Su area, just west of the Parks Highway. This is a 100% state fire. It was at $3.9 million, so just under $4 million for that fire. The cause of that was a four-wheeler was the cause, so not a power line fire, to be clear. And then that fire was just a couple thousand acres, so relatively small fire during a wind event. And the third fire you referenced is the McKinley fire. That, again, is in the Mat-Su area just out of Willow. That fire to date is at $14.3 million. That's 86% of that was state. The rest of it was under different ownership, BLM or Native, and that's all covered by DOI. So those are the three fires you referenced with associated costs. And if you have any additional questions on those, I can answer that for you.
I just have a couple of follow-ups, and then I'll see if other members in the committee. On the Swan Lake fire, which was federal, does that mean the state spent $44.5 million fighting the fire, but you're getting fully reimbursed by the federal government?
No, the state on that fire paid roughly, I believe it was $27 million, and we are being 100% reimbursed through the federal government through a process we have called cross-billing. And that takes place for that fire this year. As I mentioned, the next month that billing procedure starts.
But that's an instance. So that in this instance, you get the federal government. The other half, roughly half of that expense was a federal expense. But you're just aware of how much they spent fighting the fire, in addition to what the state spent.
That's correct.
And then going to the Deshka fire, that's all state funds for the $3.9 million.
Correct. So any fire that starts on state, private, or municipal lands is under the state of Alaska. That's our responsibility through the Division of Forestry. And that fire started on state land, and stayed on state, private, or municipal lands. So that's the $3.9 million fire, and that's a 100% state of Alaska responsibility.
And is there any potential for recovering any of that from anyone relating to that fire? Is the state basically left holding the bag?
On both of those fires, we have a process through FEMA called the FMAG, and there are certain guidelines you have to fall under, primarily number of, like, infrastructure or residences threatened. So both the Deschka Landing and the McKinley Fire met the guidelines for FEMA reimbursement. So both of those are in that process now. And what we see with that is about a 75% recovery to the state through FEMA through that process. So that included both Deschka and the McKinley Fire. Both were in 2019.
And what about in recovery from insurance companies or other private entities in terms of recovering any of that money in the Deschka or the McKinley fires?
For the Deschka and the McKinley, we have a process we go through for every fire, and it goes under an investigation which looks at origin and cause. So we look at where that fire started, if it's on state ownership or private, and then the cause. From there, we determine if there's negligence, and that's done through our investigators as well as a team that includes Division of Forestry, some DNR folks, and as well as the AG's office. And if we determine there's negligence, we have the ability to go after cost recovery. Because the Deschka fire was we found the origin, but we didn't know who started it, who was operating the four-wheeler. There was no attempt at cost recovery for that. So for the Deschka fire, that's will be fully recovered, fully paid for, other than the FEMA part, by the state of Alaska.
And any private cost recovery or from insurance companies in the McKinley fire?
I'm unaware of all the activities. I do know there are some civil claims out. I don't know how many and for what amount, but I am aware there is a potential for civil claims from individuals who lost homes on the McKinley fire. I don't have a lot of additional information on that, though.
But that's actually those homeowners looking for recovery as opposed to the state looking for recovery for the amount that it's paid.
That's correct. And at this time, the state of Alaska is not looking at cost recovery for that incident.
Okay. Follow-up questions. Actually, Representative Drummond, you were next in the queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, my question is regarding the proposed example of the language that Ms. Elliott, I believe, and her group has provided. It appears to recommend that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska create a wildfire protection plan, wildland fire protection plan. I'm not clear on whether we already have that, if that's something that this insurance organization is recommending that we have. I have not had the time to investigate whether we've already got a wildland fire.
I can answer that. We do not.
We do not.
No, what they are suggesting is that we consider, rather than modifying the bill that's before us, to be somewhat similar or some degree similar to what they did in Utah.
And that would require a wildland fire protection plan. And that seems to vary in the language from wildland protection plan to wildland fire protection plan, and I'm not real clear on that.
Well, and so I wouldn't get too tied to the language in the proposal. I think the question for us as a committee will be, do we want to look at ways to create, having the RCA involved in approval of these, whether that's they create plans they have to comply with or whether they approve the plans the utilities submit, I think would be up to us to try to figure out. But I think that the notion with the Utah statute is that there would be more regulatory supervision of where a vegetation management plan looks like, and it would be up to us as a legislature, and the starting point might well be this committee, to figure out what we think is a reasonable way to regulate that. And I don't think we're necessarily committed to what Utah did or anything else, and we might have different concerns that Utah didn't have. I've got Representative Kirka, then after Representative Eastman, and Representative Vance, you want in the queue, or are you okay right now? All right, Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We were just listening to the numbers on the cost of some of these fires in terms of fighting them and some of the liability and who was at fault. And I guess a kind of an obvious question, I know this is concern for this bill comes from out of state, but have there been any fires in Alaska that have been attributed to negligence on behalf of utilities, or they were held liable for fires in Alaska that were caused from trees outside their control hitting their power lines?
I will note that the Daily News article that we circulated earlier does identify there's a lawsuit currently being filed against Matanuska Electric Association by some insurance companies in the subrogation setting that has been described. So that's a fairly new lawsuit. I think it was filed in November or December of this year, so that case obviously hasn't been resolved. But that's a larger question for we'll start with Mr. Lehman. Mr. Lehman, are you aware of lawsuits being filed in the past against electric utilities related to wildfires?
Andy Lehman, for the record. I believe there was some discussion about this at the prior hearing, and I think you're correct, Chair Klayman, that the Daily News article talked about the very recent MEA lawsuit. I do believe there's been maybe one other lawsuit a couple of years ago involving a situation like that. But again, what got the Alaska utilities interested in this really was preceded that with some of the fires in the lower 48 in New Mexico in particular that had scenarios very similar to that, and it just wasn't hard to imagine a similar lawsuit arising in Alaska. And
does that answer the question to your satisfaction, Representative Kirker?
Yeah, I think that answers the questions we have. I remember we had the conversation in the previous committee, but I guess I was asking more specifically with the fire chief with their investigation in determining who is at fault. In his experience, have there been ever a time where he's determined the utilities were at fault? And I will review that ADN article again.
Actually, that's a good question for Mr. McDonald. Mr. McDonald, are you aware of any lawsuits, and to your knowledge, of where utilities were sued for fire damage, and if you know about them, what the result of those cases were?
Speaking just for Alaska, I do have some numbers that we pulled. We, from 2011 to 2019, we had 313 power line fires, and of those, the largest and the most expensive were the McKinley fire in the Matsu. We had a Twin Creek fire on Kodiak Island, which was about just under 5,000 acres. A fire out of Tyonic, which was just under 2,000 acres, and then some additional smaller ones in that time period. Of all those fires, we had one where we worked with the power companies, and this was Tyonic, and settled without going to court. So I guess to answer your question, we've had 313 power line fires. One involved our attorneys and the power companies, and that was settled out of court.
And I don't, you can correct me, I don't believe there were any lawsuits related to the Twin Creeks fire in Kodiak.
Not from the state of Alaska. I'm unfamiliar if there was from any of the other land managers or owners.
Right, okay.
I guess to clarify, was
Representative Kirker, go ahead.
What, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was the fault found ever to be a tree from outside the easement, so to speak, that fell into the power line and that then the utility was held liable for that, and or was pursued? In this case, it looks like there's a couple cases that they're pursued, which could have been their own vegetation, or was it vegetation from outside the utility easement?
Yeah, I think to answer that question, I would turn that over to our attorney general who worked on that case. I think there was some discussion about what was what would be determined as the cause. So I can if you're okay with that, I'll turn that over to our attorney general to give you a reply to that question.
Do you have an AG online?
I don't believe so, but we have one that we have an appointed AG that worked on that particular incident in that case.
Okay, so we can get that, not today, but we can get that, get back to you with an answer. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. For the benefit of the committee, I just wanted to point out that the numbers for costs for each of those fires, two of them were in my district. The liability we're talking about in this bill would include the costs of fire suppression, which were mentioned, but those numbers do not include the damage to actual structures, of which there were many in some of those fires, and so that cost of liability is significantly higher, potentially to the utility, than just the cost of fighting the fire.
Okay. I don't see any other questions from the committee. The query, in light of the discussions, and we've seen the Utah statute and the comments from the insurance company, I had asked folks before deciding whether to move the bill, whether we wanted to continue to hold the bill and consider looking at a structure that was, I wouldn't say identical, but take a look at the Utah statute, take a look at the comments from the insurance company, and potentially look at a different version of the bill that tries to address some of those. And I know I've had one member of the committee who said, definitely don't move the bill today. They're interested in looking at options. What's the thought on other members of the committee? Representative Vance, I'll give you first run at this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to hear from our utility companies what they think of the proposed language, because I think the decision that we have is finding that perfect balance that protects the residents of Alaska from an increased cost, whether that is an increased cost on the side of the utility having to defend their liability, or on the insurance side where rates could be raised. So we're having to strike that perfect balance. And, I'd like to have we've heard from the side of the insurance, we've heard the side from, the state with fire management. So I think we need to hear from the utility companies, because what we're doing is saying, hey, if we provide a clear definition on a vegetation management plan, will that improve everyone's ability to provide that proper balance? And I think that's kind of the meat of where we're at in the discussion.
Mr. Lehman, is Alaska Power Association in a position at this point to provide comment as to either the proposed language, and that's certainly not before the committee right now, as I've said multiple times, but are you prepared today to provide any perspectives on the proposed language, either that was offered by the APCIA or a perspective on the Utah statute, which I believe is the maybe a better one to comment on, but are you all prepared to offer a perspective on that today, or do you want some time to think about that?
Andy Lehman for the record. Yeah, thank you, Chair Klayman. We just saw this language a couple of hours ago. We haven't had a chance to discuss it with our members. I do think there are some real concerns with it, but if we could have a little bit of time to consult with our members and kind of gather their feedback for the committee, that would be most appreciated.
Were you thinking 5 minutes or 5 days? You don't need to answer that. That's okay. Representative Vance, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification, in the discussion, with your members is, would a clarified vegetation management plan through regulation with the RCA, would that be helpful, or would that be overburdensome for the ratepayers?
And I would just note there's a third part, Representative Vance. I think you very correctly identified what's the impact on homeowners' policies and what's the impact on utility rates.
Right.
But there's a third feature which is highlighted by the cost, is that there's also the state and the federal government that's part of the package, because when we have these fires and they have to be fought, somebody's got to be there, and when there's no other money available, it's going to be the state and potentially reimbursed by the federal government. And I think Representative Eastman is also quite correct that those costs reflect what is the cost to DNR to have the firefighters out there, but mm-hmm. if my house burned down, they may have incurred a cost putting the fire on at my house, but but the rebuilding is not going to be paid by the state. Further thoughts, comments? It sounds like you're interested in seeing, well, we want to hear from the utilities and some interest in seeing what we might come up with. Representative Kirka, Representative Eastman, Representative Drummond. I think there's a general sense that we should hold the bill, and we will schedule a time next week, and I will, notwithstanding my joke about 5 days, it won't be Monday, that we'll ask the utilities to come back with some comments, but we will hold the bill and continue to look at that. My general perspective is that if we want to go down that path, that we're more likely to work, my office will work on a committee substitute, work with the bill sponsor for a committee substitute, and work with the utilities and the insurance interest to try to craft a committee substitute to that we can then present and then kind of take up a more typical amendment process at that point. I think if we tried to craft a substitute by amendment, we'll be here till August, and then we'd be in the midst of fire season, and that wouldn't work for anybody. So that's my thought about how we'll that's how we'll proceed on that. So we have an indeterminate schedule, but we are going to look at all those issues. And Mr. Lehman, in your discussions with your members, one of the things that I would think would be very helpful, if you looked at both kind of to the extent that we're looking at some kind of an RCA participation in vegetation management plans, whether you would find it more useful for that to be the RCA coming up with a plan that everybody has to abide by, or whether your companies would be more interested in a structure in which they prepared a plan and submitted it to the RCA for approval, so that you're not looking at necessarily a uniform plan for the whole state, but that it just would create a structure for regulatory approval of the plans that each company was preparing. And you don't obviously need an opinion on that today, but I think that distinction between a plans that are created by RCA versus plans that are approved by RCA would be a distinction that I think would be helpful to the committee in pondering how we approach this. So I think that's everything for today. We're going to adjourn. Our next meeting is Monday, April 12th at 1 p.m., and with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:12 p.m.